I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. U.S. President Joe Biden is urging Israel to be careful in how it responds to Iran's missile barrage. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Asked if he'd back an Israeli attack on Iranian nuclear sites?
The answer is no.
Saying he and fellow G7 leaders who talked this morning amid fears the region will devolve into all-out war would rather see Israel mount a more proportional response. Iranian Ambassador Amir Saeed Iravani says the missile strikes were in self-defense after months of Israeli aggression and gave his own warning.
Iran is fully prepared to take further defensive measures.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Israel is pressing forward on two fronts. The Israeli military is pursuing a ground incursion into Lebanon against Hezbollah that left 8 Israeli soldiers dead Wednesday and conducting strikes in Gaza that killed dozens, including children. As Israel vowed to retaliate for Iran's ballistic missile attack a day earlier, the region braced for further escalation. Iran launched dozens of missiles into Israel on Tuesday night. It was another escalation in a tit-for-tat cycle that is pushing the Middle East closer to a regional war. Israel warned that the attack would have, quote, repercussions. U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed his commitment to supporting North Carolina on Wednesday during a meeting in an operational center in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the wake of destruction from a historic Hurricane Helene.
Today, I approve the request of Governor Cooper for the federal government to cover 100% of all the costs for debris removal, emergency protective measures, for 6 months.
Meanwhile, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris visited Augusta, Georgia on Wednesday to meet with victims and announce federal funds to cover local costs following the storm. This is VOA News. Prosecutors say Donald Trump laid the groundwork to try to overturn the 2020 election even before he lost, knowingly pushed false claims of voter fraud, and, quote, resorted to crimes in his failed bid to cling to power. A newly unsealed court filing lays out fresh details from the landmark criminal case against the former president. It argues that the former president is not entitled to immunity from prosecution. It was submitted by special counsel Jack Smith's team following a Supreme Court opinion that conferred broad immunity on former presidents and narrowed the scope of the prosecution. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed to move forward with a reset in relations at pace on Wednesday as they eye further cooperation on areas such as security and economic challenges. Starmer, whose Labour Party won an election in July, has said his government will not seek wholesale negotiation of the Brexit deal that took Britain out of the European Union in 2020.
There will be no return to freedom of movement, no return to the customs union, no return to the single market. But we will find constructive ways to work together and deliver for the British people.
Starmer and von der Leyen agreed to hold regular EU-UK leader summits, with the first set to take place in early 2025. Nigeria's Emergency Management Agency says 14 bodies have been recovered so far in central Niger state, where around 150 passengers are missing after a boat capsized late Tuesday. Authorities say the tragedy was caused by overloading the boat. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
Zainab Suleiman is the Niger State Emergency Coordinator.
Right now, there are 14 corpses that have been recovered, and there are still the local people, divers. They are still going about recovering. They are in the waters right now, and the boat was overloaded.
Boat accidents are not uncommon in Nigeria, where safety regulations on waterways, including load limits and the use of safety jackets, are poorly enforced and often ignored by locals. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The bodies of almost 24 young students and teachers who died in a bus fire in a suburb of Bangkok have been returned to central Thailand, where they began their ill-fated school field trip. Friends, relatives, and Buddhist monks waited past midnight for the last of several convoys carrying remains, as well as relatives who had to go to Bangkok to help with the DNA identification of the severely burned victims. Thai police are investigating whether Tuesday's fire on the bus
presses forward on two fronts.
Hezbollah said its fighters were engaging Israeli forces inside Lebanon.
The death toll from a large Israeli operation in southern Gaza has climbed to over 50.
Russian troops have taken a strategic city in Ukraine's Donbas region.
Russian troops reached the center of Vuhledar on Tuesday. The town was considered a strategic bastion that had resisted Russian assaults since Moscow's full-scale invasion.
And scientists have made the first wiring diagram of a fruit fly brain.
What can you learn from one dead fly? Turns out quite a lot.
Today is Thursday, October 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Israel pressed forward on two fronts Wednesday, pursuing a ground incursion into Lebanon against Hezbollah that left eight Israeli soldiers dead, and conducting strikes in Gaza that killed dozens, including children. We begin in southern Lebanon with Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones.
Hezbollah said its fighters were engaging Israeli forces inside Lebanon on Wednesday. Such ground clashes would be the first since Israel began pushing into its northern neighbor in a campaign against the Iran-backed group. Video released by Israel's military purports to show its troops in southern Lebanon. Reuters was not able to independently verify the location or the date when the video was filmed. The IDF said regular infantry and armored units were joining its ground operations in Lebanon. That's a day after Israel was attacked by Iran, prompting fears of a wider conflict in the Middle East. Iran said the attack, its biggest on Israel, was over barring further provocation. But Israel and the United States have promised to hit back. The violence, meanwhile, continued on the Israeli-Lebanon border. Displaced people like Ada have been flocking to this shelter in the southern Lebanese city, Sidon.
God willing, Hezbollah will be victorious. The land is precious. What can we do? It is now soaked in blood. May God give them victory.
Hezbollah said it was clashing with Israeli troops in the border town of Marun El Ras. That's after it said pushing back forces near other border towns. Hezbollah also said it had fired rockets at military posts inside Israel. The group's media chief said those battles were only, quote, the first round, and that it had enough fighters, weapons and ammunition to push Israel back. There was no immediate comment from Israel. However, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant visited troops near the border on Wednesday. He said those who harm Israel will, quote, pay the price. The Israeli military has said its incursion is largely aimed at destroying tunnels and other infrastructure on the border. It has also said there were no plans for a wider operation targeting Beirut or other major cities in southern Lebanon. Nearly 1,900 people have been killed and more than 9,000 wounded in Lebanon in almost a year of cross-border fighting, with most of the deaths occurring in the past 2 weeks. According to Lebanese government statistics, more than a million people have been forced to flee their homes.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. While IDF forces battled Hezbollah in Lebanon, they also conducted attacks against Hamas in Gaza. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma takes us there.
Gaza's health ministry says the death toll from a large Israeli operation in southern Gaza has climbed to over 50, the number including many women and children. The European hospital in Khan Yunis says it received bodies after heavy airstrikes and ground operations in the city overnight and into Wednesday. There was no immediate comment from the Israeli military. Israel has continued to strike what it says are militant targets across Gaza nearly a year after Hamas's October 7 attack ignited the war. That's even as attention has shifted to Lebanon, where Israel is battling Hezbollah, and to Iran, which launched a ballistic missile attack on Israel late on Tuesday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
At the United Nations, the Security Council took up the matter of Iran's missile attack on Israel.
The raging fires in the Middle East are fast becoming an inferno.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Exactly 1 week ago, I briefed the Security Council about the alarming situation in Lebanon. Since then,
Things have gone from bad to much, much worse.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield told the council,
I can think of no starker example of state support of terrorism than launching ballistic missiles to avenge the death of a terrorist leader. It is indefensible and it is unacceptable.
And she issued this warning.
Let me be clear. The Iranian regime will be held responsible for its actions, and we strongly warn against Iran or its proxies taking actions against the United States or for their actions against Israel.
Iran's UN ambassador, Amir Sayed Irvani, said the missile attack on Tuesday was to restore balance and deterrence.
The only way to prevent further escalation is clear. Israel must immediately cease its war on Gaza and its attacks on Lebanon must stop.
Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Dannon, pushed back.
Let me be clear. Israel will defend itself. We will act. And let me assure you, the consequences Iran will face for their actions will be far greater than they could ever have imagined.
A warning also issued in Israel from the chief of the general staff. He's saying that Israel will respond to Iran's missile attack and its forces can strike anywhere in the Middle East. Israel's foreign minister said on Wednesday that he was banning UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres from entering the country because he had not unequivocally condemned Iran's missile attack on Israel. At the U.S. State Department, spokesman Matthew Miller says that was not helpful.
We don't think it's a productive step at all, because, precisely because of the reasons you identify, which is the UN does incredibly important work in Gaza, does incredibly important work in the region, and the UN, when it's acting at its best, can play an important role for security and stability. So we think it's important that Israel be able to engage with the UN. One of the things we've always said that Israel needs to be cognizant of throughout this conflict is its standing in the world. And steps like this are not productive to improving its standing in the world.
Israel's campaign against Hamas in the aftermath of its attack a year ago has seen President Tayyip Erdogan at the forefront of condemning Israel. However, analysts say Turkey is becoming increasingly sidelined from efforts to end the crisis in a region where Erdogan once sought to play a leading role. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah is one of the few remaining medical facilities serving about half of the Gaza Strip's nearly 2 million people. For Dr. Ibrahim Abu Sakur, a refugee from the north of Gaza, every day brings more casualties from the fighting between Israel and Hamas.
It's wartime. The wounded are expected to come at any moment. Anything is expected. Problems and challenges, especially in the operating room. We are always thinking of how we could manage the situation with the larger number of injuries that could come every single hour. How and where to find a place for them and to treat them.
Along with working to find beds for newly arrived patients, Abu Sakur is the hospital's head of general surgery. He starts his day visiting patients, among them Imam Al-Rai. Her mother, Rida Al-Rai, says her daughter lost her leg in an Israeli missile attack on their home and may need another surgery to save her other leg. Rida says a lack of medicine compounds her daughter's agony.
Sometimes her screams fill the place. She almost dies from the pain. This happens to everyone else as well. Tonight, my daughter didn't sleep. She needs painkillers, medicine, and treatment. There is not enough. Thank God, though, for this hospital, as it provides more services than it can handle.
Dr. Abu Sakur spends much of his day in surgery, but he says he's always thinking about how to deal with shortages and searching for alternatives, at a time when demands on the hospital are growing and resources are dwindling.
Lack of medical equipment is overwhelming the capacity of the hospital. Most surgical tools are almost non-existent. Asking for anything, the answer is always, we don't have it. There's none left. The condition in the hospital is indescribable, starting from the lack of medical supplies and surgical tools to the clinical capacity.
After a day of performing surgeries, largely on the war wounded, Dr. Abu Sakur makes another round. Thousands come each month, and Dr. Abu Sakur worries about how long he and the other staff can keep going.
I don't know how the war started and how it will end, but the injuries are beyond our capacity. This is beyond the power of any human being, doctor, hospital, or anyone. I don't know how we endured the pain and fatigue, but we are still holding on. I pray that this war will end soon.
With diplomatic efforts failing and the war escalating, there's little hope that his prayers will be answered or that relief will come for these patients anytime soon. With Enes Tantash, Nedal Hamduna and Amjad Tantash in Gaza, Dorian Jones, VOA News.
Russian troops have reached the center of Vuhledar, a bastion on strategic high ground in eastern Ukraine's industrial Donbas region that had resisted Russian assaults since Moscow's full-scale invasion. The Russian takeover was confirmed by a regional Ukrainian official. But how significant is this capture with regards to the wider conflict? Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo details it for us.
Vuhledar is a coal mining town in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region. It was built by the Soviet Union in the mid-1960s and now counts two mines with significant coal reserves. Moscow sees taking control of Vuhledar as an important stepping stone, but why? The town was long regarded as one of Ukraine's toughest fortified positions to crack. Controlling it is key because it sits at the intersection of the eastern and southern battlefield fronts. Taking Vuhledar opens the way for Russian forces to advance on other places. Russian forces trapped Ukrainian soldiers in the town, gradually encircling them. There was nowhere in or out, and Ukrainian soldiers were bombarded with devastating aerial glide bombs. Russian forces had previously launched at least four major attempts to take Vuhledar. They had been repelled by Ukraine's 72nd Separate Mechanized Brigade, mounting fierce resistance. Neither side disclosed losses.
Reuters correspondent Dallas Rizzo. Following these other stories from around the world, six migrants were shot dead by Mexican soldiers pursuing suspicious vehicles on a highway in the country's south. Mexico's defense ministry said the patrol found 33 migrants from countries including Egypt, Nepal, Cuba, India, and Pakistan traveling in a truck. He said that the two soldiers who opened fire had been removed from their duties. A new unsealed court filing lays out fresh details from the landmark criminal case against former President Donald Trump. It argues that Trump is not entitled to immunity from prosecution for trying to overturn the 2020 election. The Department of Homeland Security has announced that it would ban the import of goods from a Chinese steel manufacturer and a Chinese maker of artificial sweetener. The agency on Wednesday accused the companies of being involved in the use of forced labor. Four Russian journalists went on trial in Moscow on Wednesday on charges of involvement in an extremist group after authorities accused them of working for the banned organization of the late dissident Alexei Navalny. The journalist's attorney saying today was a purely technical hearing and that the judge intends to look into the case without delay. Europe looks set to toughen migration laws aimed at a surge in support of far-right parties across the continent. Austria's Freedom Party, which campaigned on a platform of ending migration and opposing military aid for Ukraine, finished first in Sunday's election, although its rivals have said they will refuse to enter a coalition. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Austria's Freedom Party won 29% of the vote in Sunday's parliamentary election. The party was founded by former Nazis after World War II. Its victory is the latest in a series of gains for far-right parties across Europe. Analysts say the party successfully appealed to voters' frustrations. Political analyst Peter Hajek.
On the one hand, migration, and on the other, still the coronavirus.
In its election campaign, the Freedom Party pledged to carry out the, quote, re-migration of uninvited foreigners and suspend the right to asylum. Far-right anti-immigration parties have won elections in the Netherlands and Italy, a recent state election in Germany, and European Parliament elections in France. Hans Kundnani is a European political analyst at New York University.
Another election in Europe, another far-right success. The response of the centre-right in Europe to that has been to say we have to get even tougher on immigration. What's been happening is the centre-right has increasingly been mimicking far-right parties, especially far-right ideas on these questions around identity and immigration and Islam.
Immigration is likely to top the agenda at an EU summit on October 17th. Again, Hans Kundnani.
A shift in the EU towards thinking much more in terms of a fortress Europe that's, you know, building a wall, essentially, around the EU.
It's a sharp turnaround from 2015, when nearly 2 million irregular migrants entered the EU. A fifth of that number entered in 2023. The bloc has agreed to a new pact on asylum and migration, due to come into force in 2026. It's unlikely to calm Europe's debate on immigration anytime soon. Migration expert Raphael Bossong of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs.
To get that into place, to really work as a system as it's intended, is even for 2 years highly ambitious.
While opposition to immigration unites far-right parties, they are divided over support for Ukraine. Austria's Freedom Party and the Alternative for Germany Party oppose military aid for Kyiv and want to end sanctions on Moscow. Yet other far-right parties, such as the Brothers of Italy, are pro-Ukrainian. Again, analyst Hans Kundnani.
If you're on the far right but you're pro-Ukrainian, then I think a lot of European centrists have no problem with that. And they're willing to turn a blind eye to almost anything else that these far-right parties do, especially on questions like immigration.
Austria's Freedom Party is short of a majority, and other parties are refusing to join them in a coalition. They may be kept out of power, but the recent gains for Europe's far-right parties are nonetheless driving political discourse across the bloc. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed to move forward with a reset in relations.
Ursula and I have agreed that we can do more together in a few key areas, in particular promoting growth and prosperity, working together on shared challenges like climate change, energy security, and illegal migration.
Starmer's election followed years of turmoil under Conservative government since 2010, with two prime ministers forced to quit over their handling of Brexit, and ministers often pursuing a confrontational approach with Brussels. A Singapore court on Thursday sentenced a former transport minister to 12 months in jail for obstructing justice and receiving more than $300,000 worth of gifts for the first jailing of an ex-cabinet member in a city-state known for clean governance. 68 suspected Los Angeles gang members with ties to white supremacist groups and the Mexican mafia were indicted on Wednesday on federal charges of racketeering, firearms trafficking, drug trafficking, and financial fraud.
Today,
we announced one of the largest takedowns in the history of the Department of Justice against a neo-Nazi, white supremacist, violent extremist organization. But what truly distinguishes them, what defines them, is their hate and their animus towards racial, ethnic, and religious minorities. And I just want to emphasize the magnitude of what these officers and agents were able to accomplish here. Investigating this group, seizing large quantities of drugs and firearms, and thereby protecting the public. But in addition, this morning, and arresting dozens and dozens of these individuals, almost 40 of these individuals who we know to be dangerous.
According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, 42 members of the Peckerwoods gang, which operated in the San Fernando Valley area of Los Angeles, have been arrested so far. A California doctor, Mark Chavez, charged in the overdose death of Friendstar Matthew Perry, pleaded guilty on Wednesday to a charge of illegally distributing the drug ketamine. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn has more.
Chavez entered the plea in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, where he admitted to obtaining ketamine with a fraudulent prescription written for another patient and acknowledged that the drug was intended for Perry. He could face up to 10 years in prison at his sentencing, which is scheduled for April. Another physician in the case, Dr. Salvador Plasencia, has pleaded not guilty, as has co-defendant Jasmine Sangha. Authorities say Sangha was an illicit supplier of the drug and was known as the ketamine queen. Chavez also acknowledged providing ketamine to Plasencia and that he understood it should only be administered under medical supervision with proper safety equipment nearby. According to court documents, Plasencia administered ketamine to Perry at the actor's home and supplied vials that were injected by his live-in assistant, Kenneth Iwamasa. Plasencia's lawyer has said his client properly prescribed and administered ketamine to Perry. Perry died last October from acute effects of ketamine and other factors that caused him to lose consciousness and drown in his hot tub, according to a December 2023 autopsy report. Chavez has relinquished his medical license and remains free on bond until his sentencing. He pleaded guilty under an agreement with prosecutors, who offered him lesser charges for his assistance in their case against Plasencia and Sangha.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. And finally,
what can you learn from one dead fly? Turns out quite a lot.
Scientists have now produced the first wiring diagram of the whole brain of a fruit fly. And it reveals there's a lot more intelligence and complexity than meets the eye.
For example, we know that they can walk and fly, and those are actually pretty complicated things. Artificial intelligence has a very difficult time interfacing with the real world, and yet they do it effortlessly. They also can learn and remember things, quite complicated forms of learning. They can navigate, so they have a sense of which direction they're going, and they can even keep track, if you turn the lights off, of, you know, their movements as they walk along towards some target direction.
Dr. Greg Jeffries. He's a neuroscientist at MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology, who says they also communicate with each other.
They can also sing and recognize their species-specific song the males sing to the females during courtship.
But why? Why did they map the fly's brain? And what does it mean for us?
What can you learn from one dead fly? Turns out quite a lot. So there's several reasons for that. One of them is the fact that you can recognize the same neuron in one fly brain and find it in another. So we can study this dead brain and relate that to neurons that we can then go and find in the flies we have in the lab.
And how that relates to us is that someday they may be able to map the human brain.
There's a million-fold difference in neurons between the fly brain and the human brain. And in fact, the volume of the brains, which is quite important for imaging and image processing to generate these brain maps, is even a little bit bigger. So it's going to be a while.
We right now in the field are focusing a lot on some brain sort of in between. So the zebrafish is a common vertebrate model system, and the mouse is definitely in people's minds.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.